Good afternoon. My name is Ariel Brott. I'm an accredited specialist immigration lawyer, Melbourne based. And today we're going to be speaking about a topic that's fond to us all, immigration lawyers. But we're not just going to talk about immigration lawyers, we're also going to talk about immigration ministers and the sometimes fraught relationship that occurs between both parties. Earlier this morning, Justice Charlesworth alluded to an interview where the Minister for Immigration endorsed a view that immigration lawyers who are acting for asylum seekers on a pro bono basis are un-Australian. That didn't happen in isolation. That was preceded by the demonisation of certain categories of visa applicants, queue-jumping asylum seekers, job-stealing 457 applicants and so on. And it was also followed more recently by attacks on the judiciary. This phenomenon hasn't been restricted to the present minister, the present government, or even to Australia itself. Fairly recently, US Attorney General Jeff Sessions made the following comment. "We also have dirty immigration lawyers who are encouraging their otherwise unlawfully present clients to make false claims of asylum, providing them with the magic words needed to trigger the credible fear process." So what to make of all of this? Do we have a rule of law issue? Do we have a rule of media issue? And what does this mean for us as immigration lawyers? To answer those questions, we've convened a panel of some of this country's dirtiest, most un-Australian commentators. And first up amongst them, we have Michael Kazile from Sydney. Michael is the legal affairs reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. He has covered immigration stories since 2016, including reporting on Manus Island and Nauru. Michael has kindly agreed to share some of his insights from the press gallery on the minister's use of the media. So please welcome Michael Kazile.
What do you want me to know? Is that?
Can people see Michael over here? Okay, so maybe it's the podium. Yeah.
Okay.
Just whatever works here. Thanks, Ariel. It's always, do I have to leave this up or?
Close.
Okay. It's always, I guess, a bit of a dangerous journalist to talk to experts on something, because obviously as a journalist you tend to know a little bit about everything and not a whole lot about any one particular thing. But I suppose what I've been asked to speak about is the minister's use of the media, specifically, I guess that would be Peter Dutton's use of the media while he's the immigration minister and now as the minister responsible for the Home Affairs portfolio. My focus, just for a bit of background, has been a lot obviously on Manus Island and Nauru over the last 12 months or so, seeing a solution of sorts finally get moving there, but also obviously there have been some very significant onshore domestic issues in the immigration space, the citizenship debate last year over those changes which ultimately didn't go anywhere. We can talk about a little bit about that later on. It was obviously a huge issue too. Our relationship with the minister and his office at Fairfax, which publishes the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, I want to be diplomatic, but I would probably describe it as touch and go at best. I think certainly before I started in the immigration round, there was no real relationship to speak of. And people have this kind of cynical view of journalists who work in Canberra as kind of codependent with ministers and with the government. or at least some people have that view. And I suppose to an extent that's true in that, you know, you need to be close enough to your minister that you can actually have a conversation with them and check information and, you know, get their point of view on something, which is important, but not close enough, obviously, that you're just running what we call drops in the journalism game, which are just, you know, stories that the minister wants to get out there, information you run, and you don't talk to anyone else about it. I guess there are two main, but so, you know, our relationship is touch and go, but you know, not as bad as it could have been, and I suppose at least, you know, we always tried to be fair, even when we were being somewhat critical, or at least skeptical, I suppose, about what the minister was up to. I would say that he has two major ways of interacting with the media. One would be through drops to the News Corp tabloids, mostly the Daily Telegraph, but I suppose they're sort of one and the same. And secondly, by using talkback radio, which has, you know, been a favoured method of various coalition politicians over the years. John Howard very famously used talkback radio. Tony Abbott also uses talkback radio. He appears up to twice a week on 2GB. Peter Dutton appears on Ray Hadley's program every Thursday morning at about 9:15. And for those of you who don't sort of know, 2GB is kind of the big talkback radio station in Sydney. Ray Hadley, along with Alan Jones, has been, you know, held a stranglehold on that market since about 2003. He reckons that once you take syndication into account, he has between 500,000 and 700,000 listeners on any one morning, which I think would be extraordinary if that were true. He certainly has a very commanding audience share. Exactly how many people are, listen to the Ray Hadley program at any one time is, I think, disputable. Anyway, I'll come back to that in one second. The stories that you read in the telly, in the Daily Telegraph, that appear by Peter Dutton's hand are usually, I mean, I can understand as a journalist with the opposing newspaper, with the telly's competitor, why he chooses to do that in that way. There tend to be stories about, you know, cancelling visas, deporting criminals, cracking down on asylum seekers in various ways. And they're stories that naturally would appeal to a kind of conservative tabloid, suburban tabloid audience. So I can understand why those stories appear in the Daily Telegraph or in the Advertiser here, rather than in our newspapers or even in the Australian, which, you know, I think the minister may engage in with security issues because that tends to be an interest of that newspaper, but he doesn't tend to really get that involved in, say, the Australian or the Financial Review when it comes to stories about asylum seekers. What he tends to do, how he tends to use 2GB in his weekly appearance there, is to engage in issues outside his portfolio, not directly involved in his portfolio. So, you know, that's where you'll get comments, say, about the judiciary more broadly. You'll get his, there was that memorable remark he made, I think before Christmas last year, about how we needed to rise up in defense of Christmas and save it from secularism. The remarks last week about maybe we should elect judges or have quasi-elections for judges. These are all remarks that he, you know, will make on the Ray Hadley program on a Thursday morning. And the reason he would do that is because, you know, however large Ray Hadley's audience is, it will also include people in the press gallery in Canberra who will listen to that interview to get a sense of, one, will Peter Dutton say something outrageous that we should then report, or something not outrageous but interesting? And also, we listen to that program to get a taste of what the kind of conservative faction within the government is thinking about an issue that might be playing out that morning or that week. Peter Dutton is regarded by, certainly at least people in the gallery and the government, as the kind of standard bearer, the flag waver for the conservative faction within the government at the moment. There's a bit of sophistry in that, you know, technically Matthias Cormann is a more senior person within the government. There's also Scott Morrison, but Peter Dutton is seen as the kind of quote-unquote leading conservative, very powerful, you know, very influential on Malcolm Turnbull, and, you know, a presumptive leader if Malcolm Turnbull should, you know, fall under a bus tomorrow or something like that. And so you've seen him generate headlines from those two GB interviews 2 weeks in a row now, firstly by calling for, you know, the public to be involved in selecting judges, which got a headline, and then just this week for crying in an interview with Ray Hatley when they were called up by the father of a victim of crime. I think they were trying to get the, I can't remember the details, but they were, you know, Peter Dutton was looking into trying to deport the guy who did it back to New Zealand, and then the father called up and was very emotional. And there just happened to be a camera in the radio studio to catch that, which is very fortunate. Now, I mean, I tried to get, I'll just give you a quick example of, you know, how ministers, different ministers can engage with the media. I thought it was an excellent, you know, I thought Peter Dutton's idea about electing judges was a lay down in the Zaire of a story. I mean, everyone will click on that and want to read it. And so I tried to engage him on that by calling up and saying, hey, you know, do you want to talk about this properly, flesh it out? What exactly do you mean by that? And he said, no, I'm not going to say anything more. Which, you know, I mean, some ministers will, you know, call you up from their mobile. You know, George Brandis, Simon Birmingham, you know, from here, very good ministers like that, you know, happy to give you a ring and happy for you to have their mobile number so that you can kind of do things like that. Not had that experience with Mr. Dutton, which, you know, is his prerogative. He's able to talk to the media outlets that he wants to. I must say, for that matter, Shane Newman, who you might have seen yesterday, is also basically very media shy. In my experience, I tried to interview him yesterday. He declined that. His portfolio, some might say, is basically, well, his presence at least is close to non-existent. Everything he says or does has to be okayed by Bill Shorten's office, and that's obviously because for Labor, immigration and asylum seekers is an extremely sensitive issue on which, you know, they can't afford to have someone out there freelancing. So, you know, there's problems on the other side of the fence too. I will say this about Peter Dutton, as someone who, you know, I guess when you are in that building, you get to observe people up close and you get to talk to them on and off the record. And I think there is a bit of a distinction between his reputation or the reputation that he cultivates and the reality. I think it's certainly true that he's very smart and ambitious and very switched on politically. He knows exactly what he's doing, where he's positioning himself with the public and with the coalition's voter base, and with its membership and pre-selectors. I think it's definitely true when he says that he wants people off Manus Island and Nauru, and I think I almost wrote a column not long ago saying, you know, to be fair, to be absolutely fair, we have to give him and Malcolm Turnbull credit for actually, you know, implementing a solution that has so far led some people to get off those islands and into the United States, which is a thing that you can't say for Tony Abbott and Scott Morrison, who inherited that setup, that offshore setup. We're very happy to keep implementing it, but did absolutely nothing to find you know, a solution that would take some people off those centres. What is the role for lawyers in all this? Which is, to come back to the broader topic. Look, I mean, I guess, you know, I can only speak from my role as journalist, as I suppose, to stir up trouble on things, but, you know, to cover things that happen, but to also make people care about particular issues, make people read stories about particular issues. And I think in this space, you know, it's really difficult because these issues have been going on for so long, especially the refugee side of things, and it's very hard to make people care even our readers who are, say, more predisposed to caring about what happens on those camps and what happens in this space, even it's quite hard to make them read a story after all this time. You know, there are a lot of sad stories out there, and you know, people do get desensitized to these things. You know, you can very easily make people read a story about Peter Dutton saying something outrageous. It's much harder to get people to read a story about a sick child on Nauru for the fourth or fifth time. So I think, you know, lawyers who are actually at the coalface of these things, or you know, working in onshore immigration detention, you know, you are in touch with the case studies that, you know, can really connect with people and make people understand an issue better. You know, often we saw, for example, with the migration crisis in Europe, that picture of the dead child on the beach, which, you know, engaged people. It was obviously a tragic image, but it made people pay attention, and it changed the way some people saw and understood the issue. And so it's things like that, it's individual stories, it's case studies out there, things that have actually happened to people that can make people sit up and pay attention to these things that otherwise will sort of just gloss over. So I think, you know, we'll talk about this a bit more and I'll sit down, but you know, lawyers who are at the coalface, engaged with real people with real stories, can bring those stories to public attention in order to try and shift perceptions in this incredibly difficult area. And that's one way I think lawyers can contribute, and I'm sure I'll be able to hopefully think of a few more when we have questions, but I will cease taking up other people's time now. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Speaking of lawyers at the coalface, our next speaker is the epitome of the type of lawyer the Minister and John Laws were referring to when they spoke of un-Australian. She is a senior associate at Kamata Lemhan's Lawyers. She is deputy chairperson of the Refugee Advocacy Service of South Australia, and she's very much on the firing line of the sort of comments that we've been discussing today. Here to give us a practitioner's perspective, please welcome Emily Rubson.
Thank you, Ariel. I will definitely take that as a compliment that you give me as un-Australian in that context. And I can't say I've ever really been one for thinking that nationalism or patriotism are particularly good. So Ariel and Michael have obviously given some great examples of the types of things that have been said about lawyers, and I think this is a good opportunity for me to provide some rebuttal or at least some reflections on whether these comments have any justification in my view, and perhaps what the practical effects might be for those of us working in the area. And I've noticed a few different ways in which these kind of comments or these kind of sentiments can play out. For lawyers, this affects our relationship with the department. It reflects our engagement with our clients, with the profession as a whole, and our duties to our conduct rules, and to the courts. And in that respect, I feel both vindicated and slightly miffed that some of my comments that I'm going to be talking about have already been raised today, but I think they are very important comments and things that are worth airing, and I'll do that from a different perspective than Herana did this morning. I don't want to profess to speak for everyone on my profession, but hopefully you would agree that I've worked in this area in different ways. I've been at a legal aid organisation, I've experienced the pressure that comes on you as spending public money on certain matters, the pressure of being in private practice and trying to make important matters still be cost effective for your employer. And in my spare time, I work for a community legal centre that has never had any funding, so it has a whole other set of issues. So my first observations are on our dealings with the department. When I started migration law in 2010, there was a lovely slogan called "People Our Business," and my colleagues would reminisce on even before that it was possible to call up a case officer. Your visa was being processed in Adelaide. You could say, look, you know, this person's definitely experienced DV, and you could expect a grant with, you know, relatively quickly. And certainly we've seen a huge deviation from that type of decision making. I understand the reasons for that, absolutely, but we've gotten to a point now where on a cancellation decision, you would get a decision made by an initial, J is my most recent, position number. You really can't, you can't expect your client to think that somebody has really taken their human circumstances into consideration when they don't even have a human face to the decision that they've made. My next, I suppose, comment is on about the specific things that we're being accused of, other than un-Australian's fairly nebulous, but there are specific things we've been accused of, such as fabricating claims, encouraging meritless applications that clog up the courts, and encouraging clients to harm themselves, to seek attention in a detention environment, for example. I don't profess to speak for migration agents. I know that some of those comments dealt to different areas of the profession at different times, but I think to our clients, it's actually very difficult to see the difference. And I think that the word lawyer probably is something that's used in interpreting that maybe doesn't need to be or shouldn't have been, but to our clients, those are, I think we're one of the same in a lot of contexts. When you compare those types of accusations to our conduct rules, I think that it's very clear that there is no basis to them. We have a duty to act at all times in the best interest of our clients, to provide clear and timely advice, and to follow a client's lawful, proper, and competent instructions. So in the example of fabricating asylum claims, we can clearly see that it is a criminal offence to make a false statement in relation to a visa application. None of us would risk our professional abilities and our livelihoods to advise a client not to drop such a course if that's what they were considering. And I don't see there any being conflict there when we advise a client that their claims appear inconsistent or fabricated. We are acting in their best duties to point those things out to them. And if, as I'm sure is the case occasionally, somebody then changes their instructions, we haven't acted at all in an unprofessional manner in that sense. Our reputations are just too valuable to risk the types of conduct issues that could come from trying to be a party to such behaviour. I think some lawyers then practice what I would say is self-censorship and in fact then go additional lengths to really test their clients and become a bit of a quasi-decision maker themselves. And I can absolutely understand where that comes from, but I've always taken the view that unless there is clear evidence to the contrary, I'm entitled to rely on my client's instructions. And we clearly know from decisions of the court and from personal experience that there can be so many reasons why our client might change their instructions or might find it difficult to provide a clear and coherent account, that we can't automatically assume that therefore it is fabricated and say that we are unable to act. So in that instance, where if we're bound to act in our client's best interests and tell them if there are inconsistencies in their case, it's little wonder that the department hasn't wanted lawyers to be involved in, for example, the entry interview procedure when people have arrived in the country by boat. Claire O'Connor SC's presentation yesterday also reminded me of another area where lawyers are seen as being fairly pesky creatures. And I think that the Manus Island compensation case elicited some of these comments that Ariel and Michael spoke of. And these slights to lawyers are not new, and this is where I bring up our interaction with the courts. I looked up when Part 8B, which is the section of the Act headed costs orders where proceedings have no reasonable prospect of success, and that was brought in 2005. Philip Ruddock's second reading speech, said it is grossly irresponsible to encourage the institution of unmeritorious cases as a means simply to prolong an unsuccessful visa applicant's stay in Australia. It is equally irresponsible for advisers to frustrate the system by lodging mass-produced applications without considering the actual circumstances of each case. I can't specifically remember, I wasn't a member of the profession in 2005, but I'm sure that those amendments were similarly driven by comments in the media about the role of lawyers. But if we look at the practical effect of that legislation, I can't imagine that those aims were actually met. The difficulty facing an unrepresented litigant doesn't dissuade them from lodging an application in the court if that's the only option available to them. And I suspect that those judicial officers, as has been said by a couple of judges this morning, they would much prefer those litigants to be represented. Even if there are little prospects of success, at least the issues can be identified and dealt with swiftly. But despite this, the profession has maintained a really admirable willingness to undertake pro bono work. And to back this up, I contacted my colleagues at JusticeNet, which is our South Australian pro bono clearinghouse. They have a specific project for refugee and asylum seeker cases. And they've told me that in 2017, 195 inquiries were reached, 83 referrals for pro bono assistance were made, that during the 2016-17 financial year, approximately 60 pro bono lawyers performed 2,681 hours of pro bono legal work, and the value of that commercially would have been $758,694. And there are plenty of us in the profession who receive too many pro bono requests directly to even go through an organisation like JusticeNet, so the actual hours would be much higher. In South Australia, we've had an additional barrier to doing pro bono work in migration litigation, which has been that we have been prohibited from having contingent costs agreements. Another piece of legislation that may have historically had some reason, but that is a real barrier to us being upfront and candid with our clients about costs. And JusticeNet has similarly advocated on that issue. And happily told me this week that by proclamation just on the 6th of February, that as of 1st of March, that won't prohibit us from entering into those agreements in future. Now, none of us do migration litigation to get rich, but this is going to be an incentive to private law firms that by undertaking this work, there is a potential that if they're successful, they'll be able to recover their costs of having done so. I'd like to finish with a great example from South Australia about a local lawyer who faced immense pressure from the Immigration Department. Abby Hamden is known in Adelaide as being somebody who's assisted a lot of protection visa applicants in her time. In 2004, Ms. Hamden was served a notice requiring her to provide a telephone number. Her client had been in detention, had been released pending a decision of the court on an injunction, and in the meantime hadn't complied with the conditions of his release and had gone into the community. And despite the immense pressure that Ms. Hamden lived up to, she was successful in arguing that she didn't need to release that telephone number. I would only hope that for any of us in such pressured environments, we would similarly hold up to that. So clearly my conclusion is that these things that I've said about the legal profession now hold no weight. I think we have strong grounds to hold our heads high and to continue doing a really important area of work. Thank you.
Thank you, Emily. Our next speaker is the Director of the Public Law and Policy Research Unit at the University of Adelaide. He is widely recognised as a leading academic, author and commentator on immigration issues. Today, he'll be sharing his insights on what Justice Charlesworth called this morning an outright attack on the rule of law. Please welcome Professor Alex Riley.
Thanks, Ariel, and thanks to Michael and Emily. for their speeches. So I'll be taking a broader perspective on this, looking at the rule of law questions, and that was my brief tomorrow. This week, we discovered that Immigration Minister Scott Morrison had delayed finalising permanent protection visa applications until new legislation could be introduced, changing the rights of asylum seekers. This is big news, came out of the locked cabinet documents that were revealed, all very exciting. My first reaction was that for lawyers, these revelations were not at all surprising. Everyone working in the area was aware that there's been an effective freeze on processing of asylum seekers who arrive by boat since in 2014. And that the government has been pushing the boundaries of executive power under migration law to prevent the grant of permanent protection visas. And we've seen in the last few years the government amending the law in new and startling ways to increase the power of government in the migration space. And in doing so, it's pushed the boundaries of what is acceptable under the rule of law. It's hard to imagine a time of greater hostility to a group in the community than the government is displaying towards asylum seekers arriving in Australia by boat. The government uses the media to maintain a perception of people of being undeserving of rights. And, as we've seen, it also uses the media to criticise those supporting those. So it's criticising lawyers and judges as well, to the extent that they are involved in a legal process involving asylum seekers arriving by boat. We face an environment of bipartisanship on these hardline policy settings. The government and opposition are at one on a simple narrative that is a response to all criticism. It's so familiar to us now since Kevin Rudd introduced it and Tony Abbott took it to new heights. The harsh policies are necessary to stop the boats, to stop the evil people smuggling, the evil people smuggling trade, and to prevent drownings at sea. Just yesterday, this narrative was rolled out unashamedly by the Prime Minister in the face of criticisms of delays in processing level of the Immigration Minister. But he stopped the boats, the Prime Minister said, as if this is an answer to all alleged wrongdoing. In this environment, facing a government hostile to the rights of a particular group, the rule of law becomes more important than ever. And the role of lawyers in upholding those rights is the last bastion against unbridled executive power. Once your parliament is no longer very useful to you because you've got bipartisan support, it comes down to lawyers and it comes down to an independent legal system for the judiciary to uphold people's rights. So we need to ask ourselves, are we lawyers doing all we can? And I think this conference has been a fantastic opportunity for people to ask that question. Are we using all avenues in the law to protect the rights of asylum seekers and refugees? In light of the revelation that the government unreasonably delayed finalising claims for protection visas, this revelation that just came out, I immediately thought, was there anything else that lawyers could have been doing to enforce those rights? Have we done everything? Could an action have been brought to hold the government to account for the delays that have come to light recently? And when I think about that, I think of some of the big cases. I think of the Tampa litigation and how it took a lawyer sitting in their lounge room going, hang on, isn't there an action we can bring here in habeas corpus to get those people off the Tampa and bring them to shore? It took an imaginative thought that was not just a thought, was then followed through. The phone calls were made, attempts were made to get in contact with asylum seekers on the Tampa, through the captain of the Tampa. It's an extraordinary story, but it's those stories of lawyers taking responsibility for upholding the rule of law in those cases that it is the last bastion against excessive executive power. One of the dangers of the executive criticising lawyers is that it breaks their resolve to do just that. That if you face the criticism of your own Australian does it make it harder to pick up the phone and to start those actions? I actually think our legal profession is pretty robust, and that we roll our eyes at that kind of comment rather than taking it seriously. And I think the same for judges. I think our judiciary is very robust, and when they're called an Australian or are told that they're making inadequate decisions, that we have a strong separation, partly based on the way we elect our judges, but partly because we do have processes where the judiciary is ultimately protected, partly through the Attorney General, but also through security protection and so on. But how do we counter this narrative? It's easy to make allegations. Nelly talked about allegations that were made of lawyers creating claims that were unmeritorious, and they're easy claims to make, and they're very difficult to counter. And I think the way to counter them is exactly what the legal profession does. It stays professional. It stays on message that our role is to bring to bring our client's case before the court, and to do that within the rules of our profession, which tell us to stay impartial and that we have an obligation to the court to put the case and so on. That is the response. As well as having the courage to make arguments based on fundamental rule of law principles, in times hostile to the rule of law, it's important that we speak out in its defence. So I do think that there is a role for lawyers, perhaps through the media, but certainly through our professional organisations, to articulate why the rule of law matters. And to this end, 2 days ago, George Brandis found his voice in defending the rule of law in his final speech to the Parliament before heading to London as High Commissioner. In some ways, it was a surprising intervention. It would have been easy for George Brandis to go quietly, simply trumpeting his successes and moving on. And it suggests to me a level of disquiet in the government at just what length the government is going to, that the Attorney General would actually bother to make those remarks. It highlights the importance of all of us speaking out in defence of legality in these times of inadequately accountable executive power. When the opposition stays silent for political reasons, it falls to the legal profession to defend the law and legal process. Without having to have a view on government policy, we can and must have a view on what the rule of law requires. It requires equality of all before the law. It requires procedural fairness. It requires the executive only acting within the limits of its statutory and common law powers, and those powers being subject to the principle of legality, subject to fundamental common law rights and freedoms. Lawyers must be courageous in bringing actions that challenge the legality of laws and executive action, which are contrary to the basic principles of legality. I want to suggest, to finish, that comments by the Minister for Immigration criticising judges and lawyers are a good sign. They mean that lawyers are doing their job. They suggest that lawyers are managing to cut through and frustrate the government and its actions, which are questionable in war. And as long as we are not silenced by these attacks, they can serve to galvanise our resolve to hold the government to account.
Thank you, Alex. I'd just like to give the speakers a few minutes, an opportunity to comment further on each other's talks, if you'd like to.
I think I can say without betraying too many confidences that just reflecting on Alex's comments about George and Dutton, the hatred between Dutton and Brandis in cabinet was genuine.
Yes.
and long-standing. And it was certainly not the first time in his valedictory that George had a go, pretty unveiled at Dutton. In fact, we had a lunch that was on the record where he essentially said the same thing, that he has found himself being forced to advocate and remind his colleagues about the rule of law in cabinet discussions at numerous times. And obviously, part of that whole animosity is the fact that, while they were at war in cabinet, it was Dutton that basically won the war. I mean, he ended up stealing half of George's portfolio by the end of it. So obviously that played a role in the tension between the two. But in the course of those discussions, basically, he found himself having to remind people about the rule of law numerous times. Particularly, he's very proud. He always goes on about, this is George, he always goes on about how he insisted that the power to sign ASIO warrants remained with the Attorney General. I think he said in his valedictory that this must remain sacrosanct or something, sort of a bit of an ominous kind of warning. So I think we'll miss George in that role. Don't know what will happen from here. Yeah, anyway, I was just going to add that little observation.
Well, I've got a comment on something that both Michael and Alex talked about, which is the use of the media and lawyers using the media. And I think that this is something that lawyers maybe need to change their thinking on or could develop in new ways. I remember another good South Australian example is the Bakhtiari family, who 10 years or almost 20 years ago now got a lot of attention. Now, I know a lot of lawyers who worked at that time who said, if only the media hadn't been used, that, at that time it was very possible that immigration would just make a decision and people would have their status resolved and no one would know about it and there wouldn't be a fuss. And that's a prime example of when that didn't happen. Whereas in recent times, we've had the example of baby Asher in Queensland, and it's only through the use of media and mass amount of activism and things like that there's a baby who didn't get deported to Nauru who could have otherwise. So in a time when I think our immigration department is so disinclined to let things slide and go into the shadows, that maybe coming to grips with using the media might be something that we do for our clients. But I'm certainly of the old school where I never even contemplated going to the media about a client's case, and I can't yet imagine a time when I would. But it's an interesting comment that a journalist and academic suggests that maybe lawyers should start thinking about it.
Well, we've got nothing to lose.
I might respond immediately to that. Certainly my suggestion was not really about cases, but more generally using the media to promote the rule of law. But I do think that, in fact, even if it's not lawyers, what we do need is people in the media who understand principles like the rule of law. Because a comment by Mike Dutton's about electing judges, I don't think he's serious, is he? Like, why would Dutton want to elect judges when, at the moment, it's an executive control process? Like, they get to choose. He's purely using that as a way of just doing an offhand criticism of judges because they're not making the decisions he likes to make. So I'm not surprised he didn't answer your invitation for an interview on that. He doesn't have anything else to say. It's not a serious response. But it does. What frustrates me is that he can get away with getting onto UB, whatever it is, and be able to just make that comment, and the journalist is going to go, yeah, that's great. Let's allow the media to be a platform for him to put comments in like that. There's nothing we can do, but it does, I guess it reminds me that there's a real danger of using the media, say for lawyers to go out there, because what you don't want is trial by media, because it's so unwieldy. Who's going to win that battle? You probably won't. It's a very sophisticated game, as Michael will know. Trying to win a win a battle over popularity in the media. Oh, and one last comment. I did have a comment on Michael's paper, which was Sorry, the election of judges. That was all.
Mm. That's great. Okay, thank you. Look, I'll open it up to the audience now. Any questions? Please.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks to all three of you for some really interesting perspectives on, I guess, this really complex issue. And I think one thing that sort of struck through to me is we've talked a lot about the negativity, and certainly, Michael, you mentioned there's a bit of fatigue around negativity in terms of some of the stories with what's happening in Manus and Nauru. And we know that the government currently plays off negativity and so do certain outlets in the media. What role is there for positive news when it comes to migration? And is it naive to think that the more we share positivity, the more that might cut through? I mean, Alex, yesterday you spoke about the Hugo report, which is, you know, a brilliant piece of work around the contributions that migrants make. Just around Australia Day, CGU released a report about migrants in business. And a fantastic ad. I don't know how many people have seen the ad that they paid for and put on TV on Australia Day about, you know, I think the hashtag was Australian as it gets or something. It's, you know, these migrants who fight against adversity to really become contributing members of our society. Wouldn't it be great if that was what the media discourse was rather than all of the relentless negativity? But, you know, am I sort of wearing rosy eye glasses here? But...
No. I mean... Look, there's a school of thought in journalism, especially in the gallery where I work. I mean, like a negative story of someone doing something wrong or something being corrupted, or, you know, is a yarn, is a story. Whereas, you know, a kind of a sob story, picture story, you know, about someone doing something nice is not a story. But we do run, you know, those kind of stories. You know, usually on a Sunday with like a nice big picture of, you know, someone, you know, a migrant, you know, doing something great, or and like, you know, they get a good run. I'm only really speaking from newspapers here because that's, you know, what I know best. But, you know, they get a good run, probably not online, because people sort of, I mean, it depends. A story that people will share and want to talk about, will share on Facebook, will share on Twitter, will, you know, want to talk about to their friends, will do well. And is a good story, regardless of whether it's, you know, a sappy love-in about someone doing something great, or whether it's a really hard news story about someone doing something bad. So I think there's definitely room for both. It just depends on, you know, it just requires someone to, you know, pose for a photo and be willing to share what they're doing. Like that, you know, migrants succeeding in business thing, you know, that's got a, for us, it's got like Sunday picture story written all over it. You know, kind of wish I would have done it. So anyway, I see what you're saying. Like the negative stuff tends to cut through a bit more, but like there are spaces for other types of stories, and they do run sometimes.
Speaking of that optimism, I noticed Alex at the end of his talk mentioned the silver lining that all these attacks on the profession might actually be a positive thing and galvanise the profession and so on. What I was wondering was, These attacks that we've been getting, they seem to be working for the politicians. You see Peter Dutton's rising star. Do you think these attacks are just symptomatic of a healthy functioning system of checks and balances where we keep them in check, they keep us in check and so on? Or do you think the level of tension between the government or ministers and the profession might be symptomatic of a system that's broken?
Just to clarify, I think that the attacks suggest that lawyers are doing a good job. I don't think the attacks themselves are a positive thing. I really thank you for your comment. I think that the idea of positive stories is absolutely what we need. It is so frustrating that they're not the ones that are there. I sort of feel like, could we strategically put Donald Trump in a story and then have it about a positive asylum seeker story? Because what seems to cut through, and I know there's been someone in the, I think, The Guardian did an New York Times, I think, did an analysis of their articles for the year, and if it had Donald Trump in it, then it was read 10 times as often as an article that they wrote on a really important topic that didn't have Donald Trump in it. So that it's partly the attention span of people, and so easy messages cut through. One thing that frustrated me last year was the dual citizenship debate. I was getting lots of calls to speak to the media about that, like, oh, what a circus. Like, it's a circus, so we like to talk about it, as opposed to, at the same time, Indigenous recognition, which just went off the front page in about one day. So it's a really, I think we've got to think strategically. I think we need those stories out there, because I do think that they are the things that will ultimately change public perception, if you can have those stories out there. How you do it, I don't know.
Thanks. One more question.
Just on the point about public perception, Michael, you said, and I'm not quite sure if you literally meant this, my role as a journalist is to stir up trouble. I hope it's a throwaway line, but what role, I know we're talking about the role of lawyers, but we're getting all the time about journalists and the media, what's the role of the Fourth Estate in providing leadership and changing public perception so that social cohesion is maintained in this country and we're not just constantly bombarded with rubbish that's meant to excite the masses?
I suppose what I meant by stirring up trouble, I mean, you know, no one else heard the line about, no one else seemed to react to the line, Dutton's line about electing judges from that interview until I wrote it up. So I suppose that's kind of what I meant by stirring up trouble, just because, you know, there are some things that people will love to read, especially our readers, love to see something controversial that he says. Now, I mean, that is, in a sense, a throwaway line, but also a throwaway story. But, you know, I think you're right, Alex. I don't think he meant that seriously. So is that something that I should have written? Well, you know, I mean, I don't think it's that consequential one way or the other in the big scheme of things. What is probably more important, I mean, you're right. We need to, and I guess what you're getting at is that we need to elevate truth and truth on the substantive issues more than anything else. And I'll be the first to say we probably don't always get that right. It's hard. I don't want to blame a lack of resources or anything, but it's difficult. You know, I would have liked to have been over in Manus Island when things were at their worst in November last year, but we weren't able. I was covering the same-sex marriage debate at the same time, so that was just not possible, and we didn't have anyone else to do it, so those things become more difficult. I don't know what the big picture answer to that is, other than that, you know, we need to do a better job.
Thank you, I think one of the recurring themes in all of this is, and the attacks on the legal profession is obviously a broader attack on the rule of law itself. Lawyers being castigated effectively for standing up for their clients' rights by reference to their statutory entitlements. The reference to Hamdan's case is an interesting one too, in terms of what saved Ms. Hamdan there was really the common law doctrine of legal professional privilege, which precluded her effectively from providing the information the department wanted concerning the mobile number of the legal client. And it's important to note too that privilege of that nature, it can't be removed. It's a common law right that a client has, an obligation that a lawyer has, so it can't be statutorily abrogated or removed. And as subsequent cases from Hamdan showed too, it doesn't apply to migration agents, so they can be held to those powers. Works all this part. So more strength to you guys, I say.
Thank you. One last question.
I'd just like to mention that lawyers can run media events. I remember we've had three really amazing successes. Going back to the first one, a journalist said to me when I explained what we were trying to do, he said, look, the media is a bit like a tiger. You get on it and you've got to stay on it because it just might eat you if you fall off. So I remember that because we had this major media event with the Kosovo refugees in Tasmania, which was very successful. We had another two separate ones, so separated by a couple of years, where there were child visas, where a child didn't actually fit the criteria, so it went to ministerial intervention. And we also had another one. I'll cross to an example where we didn't do media, and I think it would have worked, and that was a case of a health worker in Hobart who had applied for a 186 visa instead of a 187, and she had a child who was mildly autistic, and of course it was refused on 4005 grounds and instead of having the privilege of a 4007 under the 187 visa. So I said to her that, look, okay, it's ministerial intervention. We really need to get some petitions going or some media coverage on this. And she talked about it with her husband and decided that, no, we don't want to cause a lot of trouble. Now, the minister refused to accept it. But about a week later, there was almost another identical case. This is with Dutton. Almost an identical case of a nurse in Brisbane who had a slightly autistic child, where the minister intervened and granted stay. Another 186 visa. So it just goes to show you that I keep on thinking to myself, I should have tried harder with my client, because in Tasmania it's easy to get coverage. And the cases that I've mentioned, front pages, television coverage, it really is very easy. But I've never forgotten that journalist's advice. Just be careful, it just might beat you as well.
And look, lawyers aren't necessarily experts in the media, are we? So it can be a double-edged sword. Look, I think that's all we've got time for this afternoon, but thank you so much for coming on, and please join me in thanking
I'm going to do it digitally.
All right.